In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be talking about Audit Shark, Hittail, and what we're looking at doing in 2013. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 107. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What is the word this week, Mike?
Well, I'm working on getting Audit Shark out the door to my early access customers next week.
So to recap, was it September 10th was your original early access date?
Mm-hmm.
You got it in the hands of a couple people, and then you ran into an issue that, if I recall, took about 6 weeks to fix. There was it was a bug or missing feature or something.
Right. It was a missing feature that I thought would take a weekend, and it ended up taking 6 weeks.
So that was September 10th. So then somewhere around late October, did you get it back in their hands, or is there something else that just cropped up since then?
I think it was just a matter of having the time to actually dig into it and figure out what needed to be done. And, you know, there's all these other ancillary things that needed to be done, because I've got a couple of different components that have to pass data back and forth. So between me implementing things on one side and somebody else implementing things on the other side, it took a little bit longer.
So, you said you're looking now on getting early access back into the hands of customers. Is that right?
Yep. So, I think I've got all the bugs worked out in the database synchronization, and everything seems to be working properly now. There's a lot of other bugs that I need to fix, but the product's basically functional, and I feel like I can release it now. I mean, I'm obviously not happy with how everything is all situated, but at the same time, I feel like I could give it to somebody and they would actually get some value out of it.
Right. If you're not embarrassed by your 1.0, you waited too long.
Right.
Well, good. So next week when we record, you will probably, there'll be some customers using it again, you expect?
I don't know, because this week is Thanksgiving. I don't know whether or not I'll be touching base with them this week. It may not be until Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. I anticipate within the next day or two having things able for them to actually use it. I don't know if I'll touch base with them, but just because it's a holiday week.
Yeah, that's a tough part about this time of year. I was just talking to someone about this at lunch. And we have a couple Hittail features that are just wrapping up in terms of ready to go live and launch and market. And I think I'm going to put a hold on them until mid-January. Maybe there's a week or two in early December where some people are kind of looking around. But historically, December is just a terrible month for non-consumer apps. All my B2B apps just go into hibernation. And that's where it's nice to have a SaaS app that does have recurring revenue, because the growth goes into hibernation, but the income still comes in. The other apps like .NET Invoice that just kind of take a dive since they're one-time purchases. So do you think you'll be able to get the early access into other folks' hands in early December, though?
I don't know. I have a few people who have already created accounts in the system, and I'll probably talk to them and say, hey, you know, just letting you know this stuff is all out here and you can use it now, and start sending it into their systems, and it'll be able to give them the results and stuff that I would expect. And right now, the big thing on my plate is to just build a policy that will allow them to pull those results back and start looking at them to say, oh, I should fix this or I should do that. So there's just tons and tons of other things that aren't in place. I hesitate to start going and approaching new people who aren't really familiar with it to be able to do any of that stuff, because it is December.
Yeah, for sure. So what is your timeline then? What happens from there? Like, are you ready to launch and start marketing by mid-January? Do you think you'll be there?
I'm thinking mid-January. To me, everything looks like it's a go. It's just like the time of year is just not good. That's really what it comes down to. At this point, I'm embarrassed enough by it that I feel comfortable moving forward. It's just, like I said, it's just not a good time of year. So I feel like if I were to try and move forward right now, it's probably just not going to work out very well. And I would much rather take the time and effort to make things a little bit less embarrassing, I'll say, and put things in people's hands, early January and move forward from there.
Well, very good. So I have a couple of cool announcements, podcast and MicroConf related. The first is our RSS feed now goes back 100 episodes. The other one, hopefully more exciting, we have super tentative MicroConf 2013 dates and a location. Don't book any plane tickets yet, but maybe pencil it in on your calendar. We're looking at tentatively April 28th, 29th, and 30th. And in Vegas. And we did actually look at 6 or 7 different cities this year. All signs are pointing towards late April, having it in Vegas again. So pencil it in, and we'll obviously, you know, be in touch more in the coming weeks. We'll be talking about it. And as always, go to microconf.com, being the first to hear about when tickets go on sale. We did sell out in about 2.5 weeks last year. So assuming the same thing happens, you'll definitely want to be on that email list.
So I'm putting together a email lifecycle campaign for my Altiris training site, and I've been getting traffic, but it's just not converting at the rate that I'd like. It's converting a lot lower. I mean, it's in the typical 1-2% range that I think most people would kind of expect it to be, but I'd really like to raise that quite a bit more. So I'm looking at putting together a pre-lifecycle email list so that when people come to the site, they can sign up for the mailing list and get some more information about not necessarily the product that I offer, but educational tips and things that they would be able to do with the software when they start learning the materials that I teach them. So trying to get them to come back to the site as opposed to people who just come to the site once and they never come back.
You saw my business to software talk in 2009, didn't you?
I probably did, yes.
So if you haven't seen the video, search for, well, I guess Rob Walling Business Software. And I honestly don't remember if it was 2009 or 2010. The entire talk focuses on using email to get people to come back to your site. I've been like such a fist-pounding proponent of that approach since then. And it was something that I worked, it had worked with the Micropreneur Academy, it had worked with .NET Invoice, and frankly, with every one of my products eventually gets email integrated into that front-end marketing cycle. And about 6 weeks ago, we launched something very similar. You know, you're talking about what you're doing on Altiris Training. We launched something on Hittail. And if you go to hittail.com, and actually it's not on, I have it off the homepage right now. But if you go to hittail.com/FAQ as an example, you'll see the little thing in the lower right. And it's kind of like some sites have the chat window on every page. We have the email sign up widget. It has definitely worked well. It's good that you're working it in, because it you know, almost guaranteed to bring people back to your site, and it's returning visitors who, you know, are the ones that purchase. The other thing you may want to think about is to do retargeting and just sign up for a service like AdRoll, and you install a tracking pixel, and then people, when they visit your site, if they are floating around the internet, then you can, you know, display ads to them.
Yeah, I thought about doing that just because I know Google has something very similar to that where it just follows them around. I've seen how it works, and I've seen the statistics on how well it works. It can be disconcerting. I've experienced it myself, and I'll say there's a fine line that you have to make sure you don't go over, because if you see those ads on every single site that you go to, then there's a serious problem.
Yeah, it's stalker.
Yes, it crosses the line into stalkerdom. I'm hesitant to start spending the time there because I don't know if I would have the time to spend on making sure that it doesn't cross that line.
It's really easy. You just flip a bit. It says how many maximum times to show to someone, and you can just choose. And I actually wouldn't recommend using Google for it for a number of reasons I won't go into, but there are other services, one called AdRoll, AdRoll.com, that actually uses like 7 or 8 different ad networks. Google is one of the ad networks they use. And so it has an umbrella over all these networks, and so you get a lot more exposure, and you have more control over what gets displayed and stuff. So anyways, just a thought. If you're doing any type of advertising, retargeting is a necessity. I would not recommend, by the way, retargeter.com. I tried and I did not like them. They didn't work out at all. So
cool. So what else have you got going on?
Well, I was doing some review of what Hittail's been doing. You know, the year's coming to a close here, and I was kind of looking at goals for 2013 and trying to figure out, where do I want to bring Hittail in 2013? What other things do I want to do? You know, I've been kind of hinting around that I want to launch a new app. And so I look back at the Hittail growth curve, and over the past 5 months, it's been growing 30% a month. It has averaged that. So, you know, some months have been higher and some lower, but I hadn't put it in those numbers because I look at everything in dollar amounts, but it's pretty freaking crazy to think about that. And actually, it's been over the past 13 months, it was 19% per month, which frankly, that sounds, I mean, it is a lot, but it started pretty small, right? It's not like it was doing 10 or 20 grand when I acquired it. So growing at 19% a month is good. I guess to do it for 13 months straight, that's kind of that was surprising to me. It did sound like a lot.
That is a lot. I think I read something recently. Paul Graham had advocated that for a lot of their Y Combinator startups, they shoot for something like between 5-10% of growth rate per week.
Yeah.
So that's
20-40% per month. That is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy in terms of a bootstrapper. You know, if you're going after venture capital, then yeah, that's Like he said, that's where you need to go. And they measure it per week because they're only there for 12 weeks.
But if you think about that, that's about 21% per month. If you start multiplying those numbers out, I mean, that comes out to 21.5% per month. So you're just not too far behind that in terms of hit-tail growth.
Right. Over
13 months. I mean, that's a crazy amount of growth.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously it has to slow down at some point because you just hit like your churn. When you have so many paying customers, even at a single digit churn rate, you're still losing a huge amount of customers, and you just have to add them back in faster than you can't find them fast enough. So every business plateaus, and then you have to lower churn and find another flywheel marketing approach. But I haven't hit that next one. I hit the first plateau right when revenue was around, I think it was about $5,000, and I went a couple months there and then shot up, and I haven't seen the next one. So we'll see when that happens. But I did want to say that I think the biggest reason, well, I know that there's been a couple of the biggest reasons for the growth. One is measuring the right things and actually looking at the data and focusing on these metrics like lifetime value and churn rate and paid conversions. And then the other thing has been finding multiple marketing approaches. Not a lot of them. It's been trying probably 20 different marketing approaches, but finding three that have really driven the bulk of the growth. And it's, even if I name the marketing approaches, it's not going to work the same for every business. You really do need to try a bunch of them and figure out which ones you can scale up.
Yeah, and I think that's the hard part for most people is figuring out what those three approaches are, because you do have to try so many things. And it's not hard to try them. It's mentally difficult to go through the exercise of failing so many times until you figure out what actually does work.
Right. And I think the first step that I was able to leapfrog by buying Hitail is that I already knew that it solved a problem. Right, it had problem solution fit, so that I could kick, as soon as I got the redesign done and stabilized it, I knew that it solved someone's problem. It was just me finding that market and figuring out the best way to market to them. And so finding that market took some trial and error. And then once I figured out, oh, these people really understand it, this group, then trying those 20 marketing approaches, you know, into that niche and figuring out, oh, these three are the ones that have worked. And some of them are not repeatable. Like one of them worked really well and gave me a big 30, 40% rise in a month, but I can't do it again. It was a one-time thing, but that's okay, right? Because it worked and got me to the next plateau. It's always an interesting ride. And that's why, I mean, one of the reasons, you know, you talked about doing AutoTruck and I talked about doing Hitail, they're bigger ideas, but they're a new challenge, right? It's learning something new, and that's been the fun part of it for me.
Cool. So are you on Twitter very much anymore?
So I do check in probably once a day when I'm on my phone. I have to admit, I haven't seen you on it very much at all. And two, I'm not seeing a huge point to it right now. Are you on it and I'm just not seeing, or have you just not been checking in?
I just haven't really, a little of both. I mean, I check in once in a while, but I don't really make a concerted effort to post on Twitter or to actually pay attention to what's going on. And I don't know whether that's because I'm just not really interested or because I feel like I don't necessarily have anything to say. I mean, I feel like I do have things to say. It's just I don't have time to sit there and do it in 140 character increments. I mean, I feel like if I'm going to provide somebody with value about, you know, insights or thoughts that I have on something, I'd rather do it in a forum that gives me more than 140 characters than, you know, something like Twitter.
It's more of a rare breed. I think the old school kind of blogger types, you look at Joel Spolsky and, you know, maybe Paul Graham, and I don't even know, that a lot of the guys that kind of you and I grew up reading, you know, during our formative startup years, they don't really use Twitter that much. Joel's on there a little bit, you know, a couple times a week, maybe. And even Jeff Atwood is not on there nearly as much as I would, you know, think he might be. When you've blogged for so long and you think your ideas through to that level, you're right. It's just hard to sound intelligent or to like be groundbreaking in 140 characters. Now, there are people who do it very well. Actually, I do more retweets and responding than I do sitting down to actually draft original Twitter content. I don't know. It doesn't appeal to me. I don't feel like I can provide that much value. I feel like you and I can provide more value being here on the podcast, just discussing stuff. And it's a lot less effort, a lot less strenuous than to sit there and think, all right, what can I say that's intelligent and groundbreaking in these 140 characters?
I think that's why I've shied away a lot more recently than I have in the past from writing blog articles as well, just because I share so much on the podcast that it's like, okay, well, I can rehash this particular idea on my blog, but kind of what's the point?
Yep, we've both gone that route. I haven't blogged nearly as much in the last year than, you know, they had in previous years. And one of the reasons, because the podcast is just more fun. It's like a less time consuming thing. And I actually feel like it provides more value to the people who are really into it. Like, it's just a closer medium. It's more intimate.
It's a different medium, because when you're writing a blog post, you can write whatever it is that you're going to write, but within any given sentence, you can say it in like 10 different ways. I mean, you can put intonations on different words, and the exact same words can have different meanings based on what you emphasize. So I think that doing a podcast, the words that you say are completely different than the words that you would write down, even if it was going directly from podcast to transcript. I mean, you listen to a podcast versus reading a transcript of that podcast, they're two entirely different things. And you can read the transcript first, and then you go back and listen to the podcast and say, oh, that's what he really meant. And I think it's just a different mental image that people are getting from that podcast versus the transcript.
Have you thought about your goals for 2013 yet?
Not really. I really haven't.
Do you tend to set goals?
I usually do, but the problem that I find is that I don't actually get around to setting them until sometime in January or February. So at that point, I'm already shortchanging myself by like a month or two. So yeah. I don't know. I wonder if this year I should probably take a couple of hours or days or something like that at the very end of this year to say, okay, let me sit down and actually figure out what it is that I want to accomplish this coming year. I mean, I have a few things in mind, but nothing that I've really written down and I committed to myself.
Right. I have not tended to do annual goals. I am a goal-oriented person, but I haven't tended to say, oh, I'm going to do it, you know, next year. Just started thinking, what do I want to do in 2013? And the interesting part is I didn't have to think very hard. It all just fell out, because it's things that I am right on the verge of working on now. And I know that they're going to take longer than I think, you know, all of them. So I have some things, you know, one thing it's like, oh, I'm going to get that out of here in about 90 days. But it's like, well, it'll be 90 to 120 days. And then I'll be working on it after that for several months. So it really is more of a 2013 goal. I did want to throw out these three goals that I have. One is I want a 2.5x hittail in 2013. And I have a plan to make that happen. And then I have three info products that they've been sitting on my list, on my back burner, percolating for about 18 months. And I just have not done another, really haven't done an info product since probably maybe my book a couple years ago. So, I mean, by the time we do the podcast and do MicroConf and, you know, run my apps, I just haven't made the time for it. But I am now taking a step forward and have a date set in the next couple weeks to sit down and do one of them. And I'll probably launch it after the first of the year. And so the goal would be to launch the other two later in the year. They'll be on, obviously, startup-related topics.
Info products are interesting, because as a developer, you look at it and you're like, oh, this isn't a real product, you know, air quotes around the real product part of it. And it's just like, it really is, because if it's bringing in revenue, then what difference does it make how you got there? And I think that when you're just starting out, you look at those info products like, that's not a real product. That's not a software product. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter as long as it's actually bringing in that revenue.
Well, and providing value. You can often provide as much or more value giving someone information than you can trying to build an app to help them do something. A lot of the times it's not that they don't have the software to do it, it's that they don't have the knowledge to do it. And sometimes you need both, but I actually think there's a lot of value to be had, and there's a lot that's not being said on certain topics that I feel like I've seen unique insight into. So I agree. This ties into the stair-step approach that I mentioned last time when we were interviewing or discussing with Brennan Dunn, and how he has an in-person seminar that he gives, and then he has the ebook he's written that have helped him bootstrap his way to being supported by products. And I guess to wrap that out, the last goal that I have for 2013 is something I've mentioned already. It's to launch a new app, and I have a specific revenue goal as well on the first 6 months after launch. Were you and I really going to build the same app?
I think so. It's interesting that we had that conversation, because I saw in the outline that you were building something, and I'm like, I wonder if it's this, because you were pretty vague. And I'm like, this is what I'm building in the next couple of weeks. You know, is this the same thing that you're building, just based on the notes that you said? And it's basically the same thing.
Yeah, it's similar. It's probably got 70% overlap, I'd say.
Right.
I'm at the point, I've well into customer development. I have 11 commitments to, I'd say they're purchase commitments. They're basically commitments to sign up for the app and to pay at this price point, assuming it does this, assuming it has a positive ROI. And it's a marketing tool. It's in the email marketing space, which is something I have a lot of experience in and feel like I, you know, could lend some expertise to. And there's several things that are lacking in today's email marketing tools. So yeah, it's good. I know the numbers, how the ROI works out, though. I have high hopes for this. I should note, I'm sure there's people out there thinking, we should talk about the entrepreneurial ADD thing, right? Because it's a lot of people bounce around from one idea to that, to another, and they either never get one off the ground, or they get one off the ground and get it to a point and then get bored of it and jump to the next one and then leave the other one to die. And that is not what's happening here. My whole approach of having a portfolio of products is that I build an app, buy an app, I spend 12 to 18 months on it, and then I either automate it, I hire someone to manage it, or I sell it. I do one of those three things. I have almost never let an app die, unless there's been some specific instances where Google has, you know, done some things and the app will kind of die on its own, but it's nothing that I could have I couldn't have saved it by focusing more time on it. It's just been a kind of a consequence of relying on Google for traffic for that particular app. But I do have, I've talked about having a product manager for Hittail, and we have a plan in place to continue growing Hittail. Like I said, my goal is to 2.5 exit from where it is now over the next year or so. I'm excited.
The thing that I'm looking at building is more specifically for my needs versus I had it in mind to productize it. I mean, because I'm so focused on Audit Shark right now that I know that productizing what I was going to be building was not necessarily in the near term, but obviously you're much further along in that than I am. So, and I think it's probably best if I build what I have to do for myself versus trying to productize it, because I need it for Audit Shark. I need it for some of the other things that I'm doing. At the end of the day, I don't necessarily know if what you're going to be building is what I need.
Exactly. We do have different goals, as we've described the thing we're going to build. Yours is focus on a kind of a different end goal. I think there'd be overlap of functionality, but the fact that you need it now and not in 3 or 4 months, and that you have a developer, you know, you said you're training or kind of working with a new developer to find out if he can stick around with you long term. It just seems like it may be a natural fit for that.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I'll be mentioning probably putting up a landing page and breaking ground on the first lines of code here in the next few weeks.
So you'd mentioned that you have a product manager for Hittail, right?
Yeah.
How did you go about finding a product manager for that? I mean, what was your thought process behind that? I mean, you said that you kind of have a plan in place for, or at least a mental concept of what you're going to do with a product after 12 to 18 months. But isn't it difficult to kind of hand that off to somebody and just say, okay, well, this is going to be something that you're going to be working on, and do you have them working on it full time? Or
yeah. So what I did was I've known this guy for over a year, about a year and a half, and we've hung out a lot. I would have a hard time. I shouldn't say I would not, but I'd have a harder time if I was just posting a job description somewhere, you know, and saying, looking for a product manager, because it's such a unique skill set you need to run these kinds of products, because we don't have a team of developers and designers and people, marketing people. It's like you need to have all of those skills in one person or be able to work with my contractors, you know, who I'm already using for the skills that I lack. And so it just so happened that I wasn't specifically seeking a product manager. I was going to keep working on Hittail. And then once I realized that, you know, this guy that I knew had availability and was going to, he was going to go start doing consulting. And I just said, you know, long-term, you want to launch products, you can learn more from me by working for me than doing anything else. And if you do this and you're able to handle the product, then it only makes sense that either we can grow it twice as fast, or that I can then branch off and build another product, which obviously ultimately means that I can grow revenue for the whole company twice as fast, or more for that matter. And so it really was a trial run. You know, I basically brought him on half time, about 20 hours a week. He's a contractor. He evaluated me as a client, and I evaluated him as a guy who's running the app. Over time, he's just proven out that he can handle the job, and so I've given him more and more responsibility. Until at this point, I'm actually doing the last several weeks doing very little on Hittail, and it's, you know, it's continuing its growth, and he's making now high level decisions on the thing. I think ultimately, long term, it's possible to move towards like an employee arrangement.
That's interesting. I mean, one of the things I've had some issues with lately is just letting go of certain things. I think part of being a programmer is just being a little bit OCD about certain things. And, you know, sometimes it's just hard to let go of things that are, you look at it and you say, oh, well, that's not actually important in any way, shape, or form. But for some reason, you still think it is. And I feel like product management, in some senses, is one of those things where if you get somebody who's good and they know what they're doing and they can actually do the job, you can just kind of hand it off to them and they're going to do as good a job as you. And don't get me wrong, it's not that it's not an important job, but it needs to be done right, and you have concerns about just handing that off to somebody.
Yeah, definitely requires the right person, right? Because if you hire the wrong person for the job, there's no chance they're going to do it as well as you do. You mentioned having OCD over certain things and not being able to let them go. Do you have any examples of that?
I think one example that comes to mind is probably like the back-end database design for Audit Shark and how everything fits together. I mean, because there's so many different moving parts within Audit Shark, it's very difficult to just for me to just hand that off to somebody and say, okay, well, I expect you to start making architectural decisions about how this stuff is going to interact with each other, because I have a Visual Studio project or a solution file that has, I think, 10 or 12 different projects in it. And most of them compile down into a DLL that is then used in other projects. And it's just very difficult for me to conceptually just hand that off to somebody and say, I would like you to start making some of the decisions about how these pieces are going to interact with each other. And then that also comes into play with, like, for example, the database design, where I did all the database design for not only Audit Shark, but for the Audit Shark Pro version of the software that I haven't really talked a lot about. I mean, it's mostly just the policy builder piece of it that I've talked about to people, but that I can envision being its own product in the future for a different market segment. So those are the types of things where I look at it and say, I have visions long term of where this is going to go or where it can go. And I want to make sure that I'm not shooting myself in the foot with certain decisions down the road.
Oh, absolutely. It's been about 2 months since he started, the project manager, and he originally was just doing tier two support, because I have a virtual assistant who does tier one. And I say it's a virtual assistant. It's a guy who's worked for me now for a year, and he actually does our academy support as well. And he's really good. So he's not just that. He's actually stepped up into a true support role. And so the product manager starts just doing very basic tier two support and learning the code. And it wasn't until 3-4 weeks in where he made a small code change. And then 6-7 weeks in, we needed some new database tables. And so I said, go design them and run them by me. And that was it. And he went and did all the legwork. It was the Basecamp integration. So he went and looked at Basecamp, looked at their API. And then he showed me the create scripts, and I looked at them, and I actually ran them on production myself. And so that's the level of control that I maintain. Now, probably with the next one, you know, I bet I'll continue to review them because it doesn't take me much time, but I don't feel like I need such hardcore control that, you know, I need to keep maintaining the naming of everything or something like that. But maybe you do with Audit Shark. And if you do, you can still do it in a review process. You know, you don't actually need to do the design as much as just confirm that it meets your design standards and the standards of your future vision for the product, which is what I'm able to do with just a few minutes.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. I mean, there's one contractor I've had working for me for almost a year now on a piece of Audit Shark where I sent him something. I said, hey, can you make sure that this gets done for this piece of it? And he wrote me back and he's like, well, here's the code. This is what you asked for, but I have a concern about X. And that literally sat in my inbox for almost a month before I actually had time to go back and look at it. And I said, well, let me try and figure out what it is that he's actually saying here that should be done. And if there's a different way to do it, then he's like, oh, well, I'll come back to you and let you know. And I looked at it, and it took me probably 45 minutes to an hour to kind of review what it was that he was saying and what he had done. But at the end of the day, he'd made the right decisions. Like, there's nothing different that I would have done. But it was a very, very important piece of the product. So, and at this point, I mean, there were some other things that he came back to me with. Like, there were probably half a dozen things that I went through today and looked at him and said, like, and after looking at that one thing, I just looked at the other ones and was like, yep, I'm just going to approve this one. I'm not even really going to look at it. I'm just going to approve it because I'm sure that he did the right thing there.
And that's the thing. If you hire someone or you bring them on, you can't trust them to make good decisions from day one, right? You have to, no matter how smart they are, no matter how quickly they learn, they're going to make some early mistakes. And you have to help them learn why they, you know, that was a mistake and just course correct them. And you'll know within a month, after you've course corrected them a few times, certain contractors, no matter which job they're doing, whether it's development, design, support, they will continue to make similar mistakes. And those are the ones that you know aren't probably never going to be your A players. But it's the ones where you correct them once, twice, and suddenly after that, you're not correcting them at all. They slowly build your trust that they're going to make good decisions over and over and over again. And then it comes down, we've talked about this before, but they'll make 19 decisions exactly like you would. And then maybe they'll make the 20th decision, quote unquote, wrong in your opinion. You know, that you would have made a different one that probably would have been better. But the fact that they didn't have to check with you on all 20 of those is totally, totally worth the fact that one decision is made slightly differently. And I would venture to say, if you hire really smart people, and that's how I feel like I've done here, they will actually make quite a few of the decisions better than you would. They'll make some better and some worse. And honestly, you know, it'll even out over time, or put you hopefully above where you would be if you were trying to run everything.
Well, I think the other part of that is that by them making reasonably good decisions, it frees you up to not have to make those decisions. Because I spent probably 45 minutes to an hour trying to figure out, it's like, okay, well, one, what are our options here? And two, what sort of decisions should be made? And after reviewing everything, I was like, he made the exact same decision I would have made. And it was not a trivial decision either. I mean, it was actually pretty complicated. And it's just, he made the right decision. I mean, what else can you say at that point?
So I have two kind of book reviews, or two books I've read recently I just wanted to mention, but it's called Standout, and it's from the guy who did StrengthsFinder, but it's a new test. We did an episode about StrengthsFinder where you and I both took this test, and it kind of defines your strengths or determines your strengths, and then it allows you to kind of focus on those moving forward, and that's the theory. What Standout does is, instead of having 36 different strengths, Standout has basically 9 clusters of strengths. And so it's the same thing. It's like $9 or $10 to get the Kindle version. And then you can take this 20-minute online test. And then it spits out all 9 of yours in order. But your top 2 is really what's highlighted. So it was fun. It's definitely something I recommend. With the tests I've taken, they've definitely hit the nail on the head in terms of who I feel like I am and what I feel my strengths are. And so it reinforces things. It's a reminder to me. I read through the reports and I think, yeah, I should be doing more of this. And that's actually one of the reasons why I have the goals that I do for 2013 of launching a new app and doing info products and growing Hittail, but not just trying to sit there and focus on one thing, is that the standout aspects is I'm a creator, and I need to be creating new things, or else I'm not living optimally and I'm not doing my best professionally. And so it definitely fits in line with what I'm doing. The other book I had recommended to me a couple times is called Double Double, and it's from the guy who started 1-800-GOT-JUNK and College Pro Painters, and he's an entrepreneur that's grown some businesses very large. And the premise is about doubling your revenue and your profit in 3 years, and that's why it's called Double Double. And it actually sounded pretty intriguing, but I definitely would not recommend it for our crowd. It's watered down, because he was basically trying to write, I hate it when people do this, they try to write these very general entrepreneurial books and say, super high level, you know, you should be persistent and you should set a goal and then do some stuff to achieve it, you know, but it's like, there was really no action that I could take on it, you know, aside from, all right, set some goals for next year. It was pretty watered down because he was trying to make it so general. I think the advice, I would say skip it. And I think the advice to take note of is to be more laser focused if you really want to build kind of a hardcore constituency of fans. And whether that was his goal here or not, I feel like it kind of leaves a lot of people out in the cold if they actually want to do take action on your advice.
Is that kind of the 4 steps to success, and the 3rd one's a bunch of question marks, and 4th one's profit?
Exactly. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. It's actually a decent book. I listened to it, and I listened to the whole thing, which means it held my interest. But I just found it lacking in terms of truly, you know, getting value out of it. And as in, I'm not going to recommend it to other people because I don't think it'll actually improve your business if you listen to it.
Got it. If you have a question for us, you can call us at our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforthestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsforthestofus.com, where you'll find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.